Hi, this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Today, I want to give you a silver lining in this coronavirus, okay? This episode here where I interview Matt Smith, my business partner, the man who alerted me to the coronavirus, a man who went virtual with his team weeks before anything ever happened in America. He is going to give you the insights, the inside scoop on why and how there can be a silver lining in here for all of us, how your business can survive through this, how you need to react both personally and professionally. This is going to be an epic episode. Again, it's with Matt Smith, my business partner at Early to Rise, the man who helped me buy the business of my dreams. And Matt is one of the wisest individuals I know. He has been a longtime friend of Mark Ford, the founder of Early to Rise. And listen, you will get insights here that you will not find anywhere else. He is not a politicized talking head, and we are here to help you. So please, welcome to this episode of Early to Rise Radio. Let's jump into it and help you survive and thrive.
We need to open people's eyes to reality without getting into what might happen in a year from now with the second and third order consequences of this. So what's your version of reality for the next 2 or 3 months?
Well, I think my version of reality for the next couple of months, I think first and foremost is that you can already see most of it, is that people are going to have to live a smaller life. They're going to spend a lot of time alone or in their home at least. You know, if they have family and friends that live with them, then I think that they'll have a lot more, they'll have good interactions with people. But our life is going to get smaller. It has to in order to be able to try and reduce the spread, or just, as they say, flatten the curve is kind of the trend that people are talking about now. So I think the biggest thing is it'll get smaller, which isn't necessarily bad. Actually, I think it's really good. And I think a lot of good can come out of focusing on that. But I think that one of the biggest, I guess, things that's sort of bothered me that I've seen lately is just that people are they're looking for like the silver lining, you know? And I think that looking for the silver lining is very smart once you've fully accepted the consequences of the situation. Like you go, okay, here's what's actually happening. Now let's, what can we do with this? But I think you got to start first with how things really are. So New York is going to be on lockdown within 48 hours. Okay. It's going to be a lockdown. So if you're used to stopping by Whole Foods every day to get your groceries on the way home, you're going to have a problem. You're going to have like these basic things that you expected to be able to go out and get. You're not going to be able to go out and get. And hopefully the city will try and make arrangements and for people to still go take care of really basic things, but it's going to be locked down. So like, what does that mean? It means, well, people can't go to work. Restaurants and bars are already closed in Denver. It's all closed. No public events. You know, CDC recommends no groups of greater than 10 people get together, which, by the way, means you can't go on an airplane because there aren't that many airplanes where there's less than 10 people. And now there actually are a lot of airplanes with less than 10 people on them. But like, so that doesn't happen. So, and it's all in an effort to try and tamp it down early. And I think actually they've been very slow, but they've gotten the governors especially have gotten pretty aggressive recently. And it can really make it so that maybe you won't overwhelm all the hospital systems, which would be great because then that means a lot more people will be fine. A lot more people will be fine from it. So I think the biggest thing is you get smaller, you're going to get a lot smaller. It's going to have a lot of time to read, you know, get through your reading list, you know, or burn through your Netflix, you know, backlog. So I don't think those things are all bad.
We are going to overwhelm the hospital in 9 months with births. That's for sure.
That's quite possible. And, you know, honestly, people talk about overpopulation all the time, but in fact, we have exactly the opposite problem. We don't have enough people to replace the aging population actually. So, yeah.
Well, do you remember when there was a huge blackout? It was like 2004.
The one in New York?
There was one, yeah, it was the East Coast. It covered Toronto as well, because I remember that day. And they did have a birth surge in Toronto exactly around 9 months later from one night. Imagine lockdown, right?
Right. Now,
hopefully the people don't kill each other in the lockdown. That is clearly an obvious concern.
In major metropolitan areas, particularly the East Coast of America.
Yep. It's going to be tough. I mean, high density environments, you know, it's, you know, people have very small apartments in New York, and there's lots of great city parks they can get out into. But if you're not supposed to be within 6 feet of another individual, what does that mean? You know, and if they have to try and all of this basically, so it's all the state, we must as people limit our interactions with others in order to sort of make it so it doesn't grow at the same exponential curve. And I think the biggest thing I think people failed to see, people who didn't understand this coming, were people who don't understand exponential numbers. And actually, no one intuitively gets exponential numbers. Nobody does.
Yeah.
Even really, really, really smart people who work with them all the time have to stop and pause and turn off their, like, you know, their instinctual response to stuff, because we can think linearly only, where it's really hard to grasp exponential growth. And so, you know, you get these comparisons with, well, the flu, it's just the flu, like that kind of thing, or that, you know, the rates of highway death are greater than this. Why are we worried? You know, like all these things you heard, and it makes sense because our brains don't work like this. But anyway, so everyone is, the social distancing is becoming a thing. That's what they're going to do. And it's all going to be voluntary.
It's definitely going to be word of the year in the dictionaries.
It will be. Yes. It'll be voluntary, and then it'll be mandatory. Like that's, you can see that trend. It started in Wuhan and it's just going all over the world, the same exact thing.
For those people that are unprepared, what can they do to get by?
Well, it depends upon which way you mean unprepared.
In terms of their basic family living right now, I mean, obviously go and stock up for weeks if it's probably too late and hopefully not too late in certain areas. I will tell you, I'm calling in on my call-in show with Craig here from Vancouver, and
it's normal.
It is. I mean, a lot of stuff is voluntarily closed.
Yep.
But I feel guilty looking out my window at this waterfront and people are jogging and playing soccer with their kids and every grocery store is open and has stuff.
Yeah.
And you knew that I just moved here, and I was worried when I flew here on February 29th. Right. I was panicking that I wouldn't be able to get anything at the grocery store, because mentally I knew what was coming. And I thought, well, Vancouver, so many Chinese, China's brought it over to Vancouver. It's going to be really bad. And it has not been. No.
Well, that's the thing, is that that's the thing with exponents, is that basically something goes from unobservable to overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like once it's at the point that you can observe the disturbance, it will overwhelm you. And so that's why you have to get way ahead of it. And so people will look at what New York will do in the next 48 hours, and they'll go, like, that's totally unnecessary. They're like, they're overreacting. But the only thing you can do is actually overreact to get ahead of it. You have to, if it doesn't feel like it's overreacting, you actually aren't doing enough. And I mean, honestly, it's because I mean, even if you think right now, well, what would be overreacting? Well, it'd be overreacting for you to go into the grocery store and really buy as many things as you could and take it back to your apartment with you. That would feel like that's overreacting. But you wouldn't be jumping to, well, I got to go get a gun. You know what I mean? Like most people aren't thinking over, when people think about overreacting, they're actually thinking of very subtle degrees of changes from their actual behavior, just small differences. So think about what you think would be overreacting and do that now. I think the biggest thing I would tell people is that they should be in a place where they're comfortable being for 2 months. Now, 2 months sounds like a really long time. It might not be 2 months, but they are just now letting, and you hear how China's coming back, but they're just letting people in Wuhan out of their apartments. Okay. Now, this was in late January. So a very dense city, highly populated. And they were letting people out, one person from the household every 3 days, for food. Okay. So that's what they're very good at mobilizing the population. So you just have to plan on go a place where you are comfortable being. So like if I lived in New York, I would go to my parents' house probably, or something, somewhere else. Yeah. Personally.
Yeah, I just had a coaching call with a client today who just got out of New York and drove down to Florida. And I'm like, I can't believe it took you that long to leave, especially because he had the option. But like you said, in 48 hours, you know, he plans to leave at 3 o'clock and they make an announcement at 2 o'clock. You miss that window by an hour. It's, man, that's tough.
And the authorities have to do it. Like they've closed most international borders are closed now. A friend of Tom Dyson, who you know, came back to the U.S. from Nicaragua, was going to go to Argentina.
Yeah.
By the time he got to Florida, Argentina is not accepting visitors from the U.S.
Got it. So now he's in Florida.
He's in Florida.
Got it. My brother-in-law was in Florida and he drove 24 hours straight. With his parents and his son. My sister had stayed in Toronto and the funny thing was, I was joking that they have this 18-year-old cat. And so they drive down to Florida every winter. And I'm like, why don't they just fly? And it's like, well, they got this 18-year-old cat named Percy. And I realize now Percy saved the day because they couldn't get on a flight because there's so many Canadians trying to get back from Florida. They would have had to have rented a car, but Percy saved the day by having the car. They drove back in 24 hours. Yeah. And I believe our borders are closed. I'm not 100% sure. Is Canada closed to Americans?
Not Americans, but other foreign nationals, yes. Canadians can still get in and Americans can still get in, but that's closed. So these things are unprecedented. They never have existed in our lifetimes. None of this has. And so you have to go, this is happening. It's not like governments do something like this. They must have some opinion about how serious this is. And so anyway, so if you're not prepared, I would just say there's still time to do plenty. I think when they feel like they're too late, they wake up and they feel like they're too late. Like, you see this with the stock market a lot. Yeah. You know, it hit its peak 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, all-time highs. And then there was some huge volatility where it went down, you know, a couple thousand points. Now we're only, you know, 6% off of the all-time high. And people go, well, you know, if I would have, I missed the opportunity to sell. Yeah. So I'm going to stick with it. But it actually has gone down 24% more since then, you know? So it's like, there was plenty of time to sell. When you thought you were too late, you weren't too late at all. And, you know, but now they've kind of booked those losses. So, and I think the same is true as what level of preparation you've done now. You have to assume that the state is going to force us to be more, to live in a much more small way. We know that restaurants are going to be closed, any kind of gatherings of people are going to be closed. So if you just imagine what that would mean for your particular situation, then what are some things you could do? So, you know, some food, obviously everybody should have a little food in their home. But I think you should plan on having, New York says you should have 2 weeks of food in your house. That's what the city of New York says.
Huh. I was talking to, I was talking to Rob Hanley today. So I had two really great podcasts, really, you know, uppity up podcasts today with Rob Hanley and then you. And, you know, in Australia, he is a plumber friend who's telling people, listen, we're going to be on quarantine, we're going to be on lockdown, and you won't be able to get a plumber. So you need to be prepared for a plumber to come in. And so if anybody's listening to this and you've got, you know, the toilet's rickety or this is rickety, you've got to fix that stuff now if it's like going to be an emergency for you, because in a few days, you may not be allowed to have that movement of people.
That's right. And I think, so there's basic things like that are going to be restricted. And I think that's good and normal. Actually, it'll actually be good for society to do it. You're doing a societal good. You're doing your part. I mean, I've heard people use the expression like, "We need to be on a war footing for this." And what your country is asking you of you is to sit on the freaking couch.
Yeah.
Like just sit on the couch. And it's hard because we're used to not doing that. But that really is what's required, and it'll, like I said, mandatory and then required.
What do you mean we're not used to sitting on the couch?
Yeah. We're used to sitting on the couch when we feel like sitting on the couch.
Right, voluntarily.
And then
right.
All those other times getting up and going for a walk on the beautiful waterfront where you are.
Yes, exactly. So in the business, what are you doing? Let's shift to that. So you run a business that had, you know, dozens of employees in a location. You moved to virtual, late February?
Yeah, February 24th.
24th, that's way ahead of the curve. What have you learned in this that our business owners who are, you know, have been fortunate enough to stay open and move to virtual need to know?
Well, I think we're very lucky, first of all, that you exist in a business that where you can actually still function remotely well.
Yeah.
So I feel grateful about that. I feel grateful for the team that we have. I think that you have to be, it's like with all things, is ahead of the curve you can be, the better. The memo I sent to my staff on the 24th, I almost sent the week earlier.
Wow.
And I didn't do it because I remember I was talking to Gary about it, and I'm like, I can't take it back if I send it. And I might be wrong still. So I'm like, I'm not sure. And then, but by the 24th, it seemed like it was the right thing to do. Like I had to. And I'm like, and I told him, I'm like, I could be wrong. Could be totally wrong. In which case, this is a good fire drill for us. We'll work remote and we'll come back next week. No big deal. But I was really actually just worried that they weren't prepared. Like they hadn't bought groceries or anything like that. So I gave them a list of things to do. But I think the things I've learned is, there are great tools out there. Some people do very well working remote and, independently. Other people have a harder time with it. You have to have really good communication, for the organization to still function well.
Yeah. Especially if you hired them for in-person.
Exactly. It's a different skill sets, It really is. It's it's harder. The impromptu conversations you have, not necessarily by the water cooler, but when you have a question about something, walking into someone's office and asking them, you feel like you have to schedule that stuff when you're doing it virtually, but you can't, you got to interrupt, people are working all day. We have all these great tools, go ask the question. And so we just try to set good expectations about how to handle it. A couple of members of our team put together like a little guide, some basic rules, heuristics, really more around how to work well remote. And then we've just been trying to update as we go along the way.
Any tools that have stuck, that was as good as I expected it to be, or some that surprised you or some that disappointed?
I don't think there's a tool that's really made any difference, but I think that everyone on our team, the people have really tried to step up, because that's one of the things we said in the expectations was it's harder and actually the business environment could end up getting a lot harder. And so we really need people to do more. You really need to try and, be more self-directed in your activities and really look for ways that you can help.
So then is there anything else that you would give to businesses that are making this shift for the first time in the remote work? Is it more meetings? Is it less meetings? Is it more individual time? Or is it simply just really good communication about what everybody and, everybody knows what to do and just kind of letting them go laissez-faire?
I think daily stand-ups or the virtual version of that are a great way to go. Just because it just is like, that's a place you come back to, you can reconnect. And, whether that's on a sort of a department level or on a company level, I think those do make a big difference in terms of reorienting and making sure that within the stream of information people might see in Slack, they aren't missing the most important thing, which is the details that have to get a deal across the line or something like that.
Got it. All right. I'm going to throw a curveball question at you. You're a gym owner. You're forced to shut down. You don't have a lot of cash. You probably have cash for, this month's rent, next month's rent, and then you're done. What actions do you take? Because this is kind of a couple of my businesses that I'm in partnership with.
I think this is true if you're not a business owner. Most businesses actually don't have enough cash on hand to go for multiple months. So if you don't have a strong balance sheet, which means you don't have a lot of assets that you can afford to burn, the most important thing is you got to cut things very quickly. You have to recognize the environment you're in. And this is what the silver lining hurts you, because you assume something will happen that'll keep the normal thing going, And if you just can confront more deeply, like what's the worst case scenario here? Like what's the worst? And I wrote an essay on, negative visualization and just like thinking, imagine the worst possibilities here. And if you can really sort of internalize those worst possibilities, you're now in a position to start acting. Like you can go, well, that's the worst possibility, but based on what I see now, unlikely that's going to happen. However, I see the shutdowns of retail facilities across the country. Odds are it's going to be coming my way. What can I do about it today to communicate with my clients? How can I be as a business owner, how can you even lead that with your clients and give them the information earlier than they might hear from the general public? Say, just out of an abundance of caution, we don't want to add to the problem by having, people show up here and spreading it or whatever. So we're going to close down for a week and just see how things go. So biting the bullet early, I think, is key, and cutting expenses early is key. Mm-hmm. I think that people naturally look to trying to generate revenue first, you know, how they can maintain the revenue that they have coming in. And I think that in any kind of really unexpected black swan event, it's about mitigating loss, not trying to maintain the status quo. You know, it's Doug always told me about the thing people get wrong about depressions is that no one wins. Everybody loses. The question is, how badly do you lose? And at the end of it, do you have something to work with? And so the part of the reason you can lose less by acting faster, by recognizing reality sooner, by forcing the hard choices early rather than late. So if you're a gym owner, I think making the call as soon as you can, providing notice to your people, and then offering some kind of an alternative. We talked about doing, you know, Zoom workouts. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a bad idea. People come into the gyms where they're working in groups, like it's the camaraderie, you know, that keeps them, that really helps keep them on task. And these people are going to need that more than they need it right now, you know, pre-pandemic. Yep. They're going to need that camaraderie. And so you can provide that in their home for them. I mean, you won't have weights or whatever, but there are things you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that I've been thinking about is, well, you need to address more than just that person, because that person, you know, most more than likely is in our business, is a woman with kids. Well, now she's got kids at home 24/7. Like, it's one thing, like, she can't come to the gym, it's a snowstorm. Right. No, she's been at home for 7 days in a row with her kids. They can't go out. They can't go and play with other kids. They got, you know, energy to burn. Now we're going to need to address, well, how can we do a workout with mom and kids? How can we get that involved? And, right. And so, you know, it's going above and beyond even that. And especially, like, you know, husband's at home too. Like, it's not like, and he's laid off and you got all this stress. And so I like to be optimistic that the Zoom thing will work for a bit, but I'm very pessimistic about the gym's survival, because at some point they go, hey, this was great, but our family can't afford this.
Right. But maybe you could change it. You change the dynamics of it by a preemptive strike. Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen. We're choosing to shut down the gym now. Like, we're not forced to do it. Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're not going to charge you this month. And but we think you're going to need this more than ever. And so we want you to work with us on how we can, you know, keep you happy, you know, as happy as possible, as healthy as possible, you know, make sure that you're getting the, you know, the physical outlet that you need, you know, that you don't add guilt and shame to this already difficult environment that you're in. So like, first month is on me. I'll take care of it. But I want you to commit to just trying to do these things and work with me and give me feedback on how we can make it better. Like, you change the dynamic so that now it's not like something that, you know, is totally transactional. You know, now you turn it to something where what it is, what it really is, because you're in it together. Yeah. You're in it together. Like, you know, you have a symbiotic relationship with your clients. Like, they, for them to be, you to be successful, they have to be successful.
Yep.
Expecting you to still succeed while they are under sacrifice is weird. So change the terms of the deal. Like, I'll take it first. Let's see how we can do it. And I hadn't thought about that before, but that seems like you have to change that balance. Mm-hmm. And then they're more likely to, they'll cut you last instead of first. They're obviously going to cut you first. I got a call from my gym the other day who said, yeah, we're closing our doors. You know, we have to because of city. And they didn't offer me to, you know, put my billing on pause or anything. Well, I'm going to cancel.
Yeah.
Like, they still want me to pay and they're not going to be open. I don't know what you're talking
about.
They're not even trying.
Got it. Okay. Very helpful. Very helpful. And then, so what are opportunities? What are positives that you are seeing for people, whether it's, okay, you know, they're laid off at work, or they're, you know, they reduce their hours, or even if they, you know, one of the partners is off, what's a second income? What can people be studying to take advantage of when things get back to a new normal? What do you see as the most optimistic thing for our listeners?
Well, I mean, my biggest worry is that people who are, you know, mostly on the fringe already, that are living paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, that are just, I mean, something like the average American doesn't, you know, can't afford a $500 unexpected expense. And for people like that, which is too many, it's going to be really hard there's not like an easy answer. So, but I think that you're going to have And this is a devil's bargain. But I think that the government is going to do some things that's going to help alleviate that pain in the short term. So Italy, for instance, suspended all mortgage payments. So if you have a mortgage on your house, you know, you don't have to pay it that month. And they could choose to continue that for multiple months. Mm-hmm. They realize they shut down everything. So how could people don't have the income to pay it? So you can expect some kind of mandated relief like that. I think actually I wouldn't be surprised if people who know who Andrew Yang is, he was presidential candidate, had this idea of universal basic income. And a lot of other people have had that idea before. But essentially, I would expect there's like a 50-50 chance that Congress passes an immediate $1,000 a month for every American over 18 years old for a period of time.
Yeah.
Now it's not gonna solve any problems really. It's actually just gonna kick the can down the road of larger economic problems, but it will provide some temporary relief. So I do think that this is what the government is for, this is the only kind of thing that they could really actually help in some way. I think that they will do some things to alleviate the suffering. I also think that people that you know, if I was a landlord and I owned a house and people were renting from it, I would work with them. And I think you can expect people to work with you. And I think you should try. If you're in a position where you can help, just like whether it's with your gym clients, whether it's with your tenants, I think you're going to see remarkable generosity from lots of people on that front. But I think you have to lead with it first. So I think there's going to be some help coming for you, for people in terms of being on the financial edge. But I really think it's a situation where I think that people are going to rethink. Here's actually the best thing about all of this. And it's going to be awful. You will know people who die. That's what's going to happen. You will know someone who dies from this. The best thing about it is that, you know, everyone knows that like our day-to-day life has gotten pretty superficial. You know, everyone wants their life to mean something. Everybody does. And, we have this idea of how we imagine your life to be meaningful. You know, maybe it's that you write a best-selling book and you have, you know, you change people's lives, you're something like that. But it never really goes exactly like we expect. But I'm telling you, in the next 3 months, in the next probably 3 weeks, you're going to have an opportunity that if you look for it to find actual meaning in your life. You're going to find ways to help people that really makes a difference. You're going to find that these acts of generosity, this kindness of almost strangers, even worse than strangers, people you know even less, your neighbors. No one knows their neighbors. Yeah. You're going to find out that there's strength in that and there's meaning in it. And it's not about traveling the world. It's not about any of that. It's about where you sit doing something useful that actually helps somebody. And I think that the world has the opportunity to actually come out of it a better place, a sincerely better place from that. But I think everything has to be stripped away for that to even be possible. And a lot of it is going to be stripped away. People who have never, you know, and this is just the first order consequences of this. Honestly, there's economic consequences that are greater and they're going to cause a greater adjustments, I think, as we go. But mm-hmm. I think you should just look for ways that you can help people and ways that you can create value in some way. So like what you did in releasing these, you know, these fitness courses that you've made millions of dollars selling in the past, but just putting them on YouTube and going, hey, you know, these are basically bodyweight workouts. You don't have to have a gym for it. If you're going to be work at home and you want to stay fit, you can use these. Like this is easy for me to give and it might actually help. So here it is.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. You're going to see incredible things like that. Over the top stuff like that. And I think, that's all a really good thing. But one other thing is, you know who Isaac Newton is.
Yeah, yeah.
So Isaac Newton was at Cambridge during the Black Plague that was wreaking havoc across Europe. And they shut down Cambridge. And so he was sort of gone. He was forced into isolation, but retreated back to the family farm. And during this time where he basically was forced to be disengaged from the world, he invented calculus. What we now call Newtonian physics came from that time. It's considered the most productive time of his life. This period, he was forced away from the day-to-day grind of whatever and had time and reflected and thought and came up with the greatest ideas of his life.
Yeah. And so hopefully people make the right decision with their use of their time. It's tough back then. There wasn't Netflix. There were books, but you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how wise people use their time.
I think it's a huge opportunity, and it's something that could be squandered just like anything else. But you know, I think most really, I noticed this with my kids. Like if they're bored, they do really cool shit. You know, if they're bored, they really do. Their imaginations kick in. They start making stuff. They start like interesting things happen. And I just think that people are going to be the worst part of what's coming for most people is going to be the monotony and boredom of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where creativity comes from. It comes out of that boredom. It doesn't come out of some, you know, some epiphany that people have. It comes out of boredom. And so I think it'll be
problems, that. Right?
That's right.
So then how do we foster that opportunity? You know, we have this opportunity to find and, you know, to take something that is going to cause a lot of pain and use it in a way that makes the world a little bit better and maybe a lot better in the long run. How do we make sure that, you know, for somebody who's like sees into that, how do we make sure that we foster that? How do we galvanize it? What do we do? Do we start group Zooms about conversations? And when you do meetup.com, but online, like, is that where we go and build Facebook groups? And, you know, some of these things that we were vilifying for a while may now actually come back and do what we wanted them to do in the first place.
So I have two answers. The first one is that the first thing you should do is that people that you love and care about, you should call them. Probably haven't, probably avoided it in a while, but there are two people I talked to in the last 2 days who I had not talked to in a long time. And it was really great. Yeah. It was really great. And all the bullshit stripped away. It's like, yeah, you know, I really miss you. You know, I'm thinking about you. And, you know, wishing you well. I mean, like, that's literally what it was, something like that. But it really, I mean, my life is more meaningful because I had those conversations. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that basic thing. There are people, I mean, so I've seen this coming for a long time, and I kind of got, my kids were all prepped for it. You know, we took them out of school 10 days before the schools closed, you know, so it was voluntary before mandatory. And so they knew it was coming, and they were kind of telling their friends, and their friends were like ridiculing them. And, you know, my son was kind of like, you know, I want them to know I'm right. You know? And I'm like, which one of your grandparents do you want to give up for that? Like, I'm like, that's what's good. Like, there's a good chance of that happening. Like, serious. He goes, I didn't think about it like that. I'm like, you should. And you should call one of your grandparents today. You know? So I think again, getting small, focus on other people, which is really where all the meaning is. So I think if you ever get lost in it, if you ever get overwhelmed and stressed out and anxious about stuff, then just, and this is the value of the negative visualization, because when Max thought about one of his grandparents dying, like, it snapped him out of it, snapped him out of his ego, snapped him out of his, you know, almost wishing for bad things to happen.
Right.
And he immediately goes, I don't know, might not be worth it. You know, really might not be worth it. And I want to. So thinking about others immediately snaps you out of it. So that's one thing.
It's almost like we are going to live in the 1950s with 2020 tools, which
that's, you know, right,
can be a great opportunity for people to do those connections and to grow and expand them and to learn so freaking much.
There's so much to learn. And it's the paradigm shift of our mental state that's the biggest place where the learning will happen. And I think it's going to be forced on people, whether they like it or not. And I think that's great. So, but
Netflix should be banned from putting new shows out.
Yeah, well, actually what they're doing is they're taking first run movies and they're rushing them to.
I did see that.
Yeah. So they will do that, which actually, you know, it's good. Like, short term, it's a good, I mean, it's a calculated business decision on the part of these major studios, but it's also like, well, I mean, you know, what good is it going to do us if people can't even go to the movie theaters for it? Like, let's push it out. Let's give people access to it. So, mm-hmm. But all these changes will upend industries. I mean, the movie theaters might not exist after all this.
And retail stores. I have a client who sells leggings, and I was talking to her before, and she said so many retail stores were on the verge now. Like, they're not going to come back after this, which means, you know, and people are going to get so used to shopping online. Like, it was already so predominant, but now it's just going to be like, you know, even shifted more. So,
right. So I want to go back to, but the big thing about what you do. So I think it's what you talk about with, you know, recognizing the Stoic view of things, essentially recognizing what is actually in your control and what is not in your control. So I think that starts with, real negative visualization, accepting the worst possibilities of things that they might happen. Just imagine them, because it won't be as bad as you can imagine. It won't be. If you're willing to entertain those negative ideas, you know, instead of just sugarcoating it all the time. But imagine like the worst case scenario, it won't be that bad, but imagine it. And then within that bad, recognize what is in your control and what is not. Listen, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. They already have, because restaurants have been forced to close in places. Right. So people are going to lose their jobs. That's not in your control. It totally sucks. It's completely unfair. It's devastating to your family. That's not in your control. But recognizing that as soon as possible is better, because you can't, it's totally unproductive stress and unproductive worry when your creative capacities could be used for something actually useful, something good for you and good for your family. So recognizing what's in your control, recognizing what's not in your control. And then things that are within your control, focus there. Focus in the little ways that you can make small improvements around you. You know, you can help your kids. You know, whether you wanted to homeschool your kids or not, you're homeschooling them now. So what do? You can lean into it. You can lean into it. You can have a homeroom in the morning. Like I do. That's why I didn't want to. I mean, I've always wanted the idea of homeschooling my kids, but like hiring a teacher that would homeschool them at home, you know, but like no choice. So I'm like, all right. So what you guys actually had them kind of come up with what their schedule would be. And we have a homeroom in the morning and I run the homeroom and I teach them about something that I think it might be interesting to them, mm-hmm. and I make it interactive as possible. And then it's also like a stand up for us, you know? So I like, what were you supposed to get done yesterday? You know, did you communicate it all to your teachers at the end of the day, all that stuff. And so we were doing that. We had a week dress rehearsal before school was canceled with their teachers and everything.
So how do they actually do stuff from the schools?
The school has transitioned now. They're still getting through some hiccups, but they're basically using Zoom and using Google Classroom to try and do it. I did push the teacher or the head of school early on. I know she thought I was an insane person, but I'm like, this is coming. You should have a plan. And she was so probably way
more prepared. She's going to listen to everything you say when you go back.
Maybe. She might still resent me for it, but
she might not want anything to do with you. She might not come to your
bad mind. News guy.
Premonitions. Not
last time we talked to me, there was a pandemic.
Right.
So the school, every school is going to have differing levels of stuff. But the bottom line is that the kids, whether there's actually virtual classrooms or not, they're homeschooled now. That's a fact. So you lost your job. Your kids are homeschooled. Well, you can't control the fact that the school is closed. You can't control the fact that you lost your job, but you can turn that situation into something positive and turn something positive by leaning into it and going, well, maybe you can actually engage your kids with some sort of learning that they've never had before, because they've never actually been able to follow their curiosity during the day. Maybe topics that you're interested in, you've never been able to pursue as deeply with them. I mean, going back and learning basic civics that they don't even really teach in schools anymore, but focusing on that stuff, I mean, you might find it interesting, or basic history stuff. I like that. So I do that with my kids. But like that's something that's in your control. Feels like a small thing, doesn't solve the problem about you, you know, being able to pay your rent, but it's in your control. And so I think focusing on that and trying to do something, trying to be a good example for the people around you. I mean, one thing that's become super clear out of all this, and this is one thing I'm really proud of all the things that you've done with this, is that so few have had the balls to lead about it, to like tell people bad news, especially in the social media world where you're supposed to, social signaling is that you're on vacation in a great place and that you have a nice car and all that. But to tell bad news in that environment, like hard truths that people should hear, is very difficult. And, you know, and when things are not going well, to be able to stand up and still do what needs to be done. I mean, the world needs more people like that. And now you have the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great thing.
You know, everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people have watched Schindler's List, right? Yep. And we all look at that and we go, what a great movie. And oh yeah, I would have done the same sort of thing. Well, I mean, no, none of us would have. I mean, that's why there was a movie about one guy who did it. But this is our opportunity to do like the one millionth of a Schindler's List sort of thing, you know, right. to do the right thing. And I think that I told my coaching clients about it on my March 2nd email, and I had clients that laughed at me. But by the next week, people started to see the writing on the wall by the 9th. But I wish I was earlier, man. You know, that's something that I cannot control. But dang, you know, it's like, could have done so much more. So
Well, here's the thing, is by speaking up early, by actually leading, you make it easier for something to, they may not listen to you and follow, you know, the, your recommended solutions, but you make it so that they can hear it next time.
Yeah.
You know, you expand essentially the Overton window for them. So they can, you know, you make it possible for them to begin this, this process. It's actually in psychology, it's called, especially in crises, it's called an adjustment reaction. And there, it's almost like the stages of grief that people go through. Like, it's very difficult for humans to move through this, to have an adjustment reaction. There are certain people that have a very short adjustment reaction. They can adopt a new reality very quickly. They're open to outside information, but it's not normal for humans. Like, it's very hard. We have a normalcy bias. It serves us 99% of the time really well. We think that tomorrow is going to be a lot like yesterday. This is the only time in my life, where tomorrow is going to be different than yesterday. You know, been through a lot of financial crisis and all that, but this is the first time ever. And it's hard for people. So by leading, you give people that, you make it easier for them. Even if they laugh at you, even if they disagree, it's okay. Standing up and doing the right thing, it creates ripples.
So be brutally honest with me. If you had my audience, my platform, which is, you know, it's got a few thousand people on it, what would you do that I'm not doing?
I think you're doing most of it. I mean, the big thing was expanding the Overton window. You're making the future more acceptable to people. Like, so they'll be able to make adjustments faster. That's the most important thing. You don't want to pick a particular hill and die on it, you know?
Yeah.
But because, you know, by making an exact prediction and, you know, and then if it doesn't come in a timeline, like, then people start criticizing. You're just trying to...
Right, it's the end of the world. It's December 11th of 2021. Exactly.
It's like really hard to keep the cult going on December 12th, you know? Yeah. So I think that's expanding the Overton window is the first thing. And then the other thing is, I think just living by example, like, I mean, like, you know, leading and doing things. Like, if we believe, as I do, that this is actually an opportunity that is going to force people to live smaller, but through smallness, you can live bigger, which is, seems ironic or contradictory, but it's true. You can start to focus on things that are totally within your control. I mean, we go from a world of being worried about arbitrary problems like climate change and transgender restrooms to worried about how can I make sure my kids are, you know, get an education and they don't lose their minds and they're not afraid of what's happening and that they can, you know, they can face the day effectively. Like, tell me which one is actually more meaningful. Like, there's no comparison between the two. So we can find more meaning in that. So with your audience, I think the biggest thing is that we see there's some really amazing things that are actually people are doing. Like, you see these, one example is, I like this guy, Tyler Cowen, who's this economist at George Mason University. And he put together this prize contest for people who are individuals who are doing things that are extraordinary. It's like the X Prize, but they're, oh, right. Smaller yeah. things, you know? You know, we're going to have a real crisis of respirators, a real problem with respirators. It's a, you know, if it's on a seasonal trajectory, it's no later than like May 1st. Okay. Like, total crisis of having respirators, which will keep people alive. But like, how do you make them? And so there's like these people on Reddit. There's a whole thread of people working to try and figure out how to actually build with things that you can get at a hardware store to build respirators. It's amazing. They will save lives by doing that. You know, so there are things that you can, my point is pointing out these examples of people who are actually recognizing where they're at and they're doing something good. They're standing up when other people are afraid. You know, they're making the world a better place in the way that they can.
And I'm a big fan of our mutual friend, Jeff Brown. He has this daily newsletter and it's, you know, before this happened, it was all just like, wow, there's so much amazing stuff happening in the world with, like, you know, robotics and this, that, and the other thing. It was kind of like, you know, most people are like, oh, you know, all the future of robotics and, you know, ID stuff is, and I'm just making things, you know, AI, it's all bad. But he had this newsletter that was always pointing it out. And even now, I mean, he starts off with the reality of how bad the situation is. And I think he's a little more optimistic than you are, for better or for worse. But then he gets into, well, here Google is working on this and what it means.
Yes.
This. And then there's all these people working on this and there's these researchers working on this. So
it's kind of like how World War II, you know, there was too much damage to make it worthwhile. But I mean, it did accelerate, you know, rubber and this, that, and all these inventions we take for granted today that came out of it. Hopefully the damage is way less bad, but the upside is good from people.
But people think of these, the difference in I don't know if I'm less optimistic than Jeff is or not, but I will say that his view is there are smart people working on things. And I'm like, well, that might be true, but that's no different than the way the world was before all this.
Yeah.
The way that the world is different after this, if you want to use a World War II example, it's not the fact that we had huge industrial capacities that we didn't have before. It's that there were 40 million victory gardens planted, and that literally half of the food that was produced in the United States was produced in people's front yards. Half of the food. Okay. So that wasn't, you know, Goodyear figuring something out. That was everybody doing their part, actually contributing to it, looking around, figuring out how they could create value, and they did it. They did it, and the world and the country was much stronger, much more resilient because of it. And so you have that chance to do it. I am plenty optimistic about how things will end up. I just think that denying that there will be pain along the way is a mistake, and expecting someone to save you is also a mistake.
Right.
You have to save you, and you have to save the rest of us, so get to work.
Yeah. So speaking of saving, there's a book that you recommended me years ago. It was written in 1999. It's called The Fourth Turning, and it's about how we go through, four generations, and the fourth generation kind of saves the previous one and two from mistakes?
It does, but there's deep turmoil in the process. So World War II was a fourth turning. The Revolutionary War was a fourth turning. And what it is that, for better or worse, in fourth turning, there's a total failure of institutions. So there's a loss of faith in institutions. The institutions have become, I don't necessarily mean this word in the way that it'll be taken, but the institutions all become corrupt. So they're either impotent, like they're unable to do something. You know, they're unable to actually do what everyone thinks that they're there for, like the US CDC, you know, I mean, or the WHO, like they're impotent, like they're supposed to help. They're supposed to save us or help us from this, but they didn't.
Or those regulatory bodies that stop, what do they stop? The delivery of stuff because, you know, certain types of businesses were not legally allowed to deliver something.
Right. The N95 masks that are used in construction are not allowed to be used in the medical field.
They're the same mask.
They're not allowed. There's some subtle differences, but the particulate, you know, benefit of both is the same. There's a regulation that says no. There's other regulations that basically they're all to protect interest. You know, these things just, you know, it's the second law of thermodynamics. Things decay over time. So these institutions, they get big, they get strong, they decay over time, and then people lose faith in them. And then as part of the losing faith of them, it creates a lot of turmoil. And then basically there's always crises that occur. And in all of human history, there's crises that occur. The fourth turning, the key part of it is that the reaction to the crisis is what actually is different than in previous generations. So the reaction to this one will upend everything. It'll change it the way the society is ordered. And there's an opportunity in that way that things are reordered for things to be way better for everybody, way better.
Fantastic. So that book is The Fourth Turning by Neil Howe. Is that the guy's name?
Neil, yeah, it's co-authored. I don't remember who his co-author is though, but Neil Howe, yeah.
Okay. All right. So, you know, coming up on the end of our time here together, Matt, I mean, I'm grateful that we were able to have this conversation and you and I actually, when I was at your place on January 27th of this year, I remember us joking about how China had built the 1,000 beds. So that was like when the news, if you were paying attention, the news was definitely coming out about the seriousness of it. And of course I just laughed it off. And then, you know, obviously you paid attention to it much greater.
I bought N95 masks on the 17th of January.
Wow. Wow.
When I saw China welding people into their apartment buildings, I thought something was wrong.
Got it.
Sorry.
What would you recommend to somebody in terms of their news diet? Because the only thing that I actually follow is I do have discussions with people around the world. I have clients in Italy right now, and I check in with them every day. And then I see your Twitter posts, but I don't actually look at any other news other than that.
because I don't really think it changes anything fundamentally for me. So for those people that are watching a lot of news right now, how would you help them get their diet to a correct amount of news and then get on with, you know, the rest of their life so they have less stress as well?
Well, I think you have less stress by being informed, not by being, you know, aloof. I think that's why people are getting shocked all of a sudden. But I think that, you know, in a world where our media really is set up for attention, because attention is ads and ads is money and, you know, it's the corporate media and all that, I think you have to find people that you trust, you know, and you just, whether it's a newsletter writer or it's, you know, or, you know, a particular journalist who might, you know, tweet separately from their, from writing for the New York Times, but finding somebody who you trust and allowing, you know, them to sort of consume and sort of explain what the news might mean for you. And you could have a half a dozen of these people in your life, depending upon the circumstances. I mean, if you're, you know, for the stock market, for instance, you might have somebody that's totally different, or a couple people, you know, that you might follow around that versus people that you might follow on world news. I mean, there are definitely some good people for different things that you can follow. And I think some people have gotten this really, really right. And most people have been totally wrong. And then now it's sneaking up on them and it's all over the corporate media. So in general, I'd say I wouldn't watch cable news at all. I think it's bad. I think it's really destructive. But I think Twitter has proven that it is a net good to society. And you might question whether or not Facebook is, in the grand scheme of things, but I think you cannot, like, I knew that there were welding people in apartments in China because I saw it, because there was videos I could find on Twitter. I had to dig for them. I had to find them, but they're there. And I see that, and you see enough of those and you go, this is something different about this. And then 3 days later, they quarantine the city, the largest quarantine in human history. And that was so early stages with this. And then they just expanded it. And I go, I don't think they would overreact like that. Would they kill their economy like this unless it was something there? And so I think Twitter has proven to be a net good. You have to be careful. It's an echo chamber, you know, with like everything is. But I think the key is that there are honorable people in this world. And I think finding those people and you know, more aligning with them to get information sort of filtered through them is the smartest way to handle it.
Thank you. What are you grateful for that you've become alert that you are grateful for? I was thinking just the other day, you know, dogs can't get this. Imagine if everybody had to lose their dog at the same time because, you know, this was passed on from dogs. So I was very fortunate just thinking, like, I know that sounds kind of silly. Who would even think that? But there's that that I'm grateful for. I'm grateful for, like, it doesn't turn you into a zombie, you know, flesh-eating zombie. I mean, yes. It's a horrible disease, but it's a disease that can be treated in most cases if, you know, with our medical system, if not overwhelmed. So is there anything that you've become grateful for, whether no matter how odd or strange that it might sound, you know, in addition to, hey, this allows you to strip past the superficiality of conversations with friends. It's not about, oh, what trip have you been on, but right. Like, hey, how are you really?
Well, I mean, that's a big thing, but I think the single biggest thing for me as a father is that it is not that fatal for kids. It does kill children though. People think it doesn't. It does. I mean, one of the most disturbing videos I saw was, you know, three children being put in a single body bag, and they were not old. They were, I would say, under eight. So it does kill young people. And so I think the millennials seem to think that they're immune to it. It's not true either. You know, when people say the median age is 60, that means there's as many under 60 as over 60. It doesn't mean that everyone is 60 or up. It means that's the median. So, but I'm definitely grateful that it, you know, if someone in my family gets it, that I'm way more likely to make them to die than my kids are, or I'm more way likely to have a serious consequences from it than my kids are. And I think that's one other thing I want to say is that people think of this as like, well, mostly old people are dying and 80% of people have mild symptoms. That's true. That's what they consider mild symptoms means it doesn't require hospitalization. Now, how sick have you ever been? Have you ever been so sick that it required hospitalization? I haven't. So I am as sick as I've been in my life. There's a couple times I've been very sick. I've had pneumonia. I had pneumonia in the fall, you know, very sick. Didn't get hospitalized. So that would be considered mild symptoms. So it's not nothing. And I think people with that mild symptoms, actually the New York Times health writer who wrote this, wrote 90% mild symptoms, he said, I wish I hadn't said that because people didn't understand what I meant by mild symptoms. Right. Symptoms can be very ill. And if you're in that 20%, that means you're hospitalized.
Yeah. Listen, you know, like think about the last head cold you had and how pissy, moany, whiny you got.
Exactly. I'm a terrible sick person. I'm such a baby about it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And then take, you know, fibrosis of the lungs and throw that in there. And yeah.
So I'm grateful though that it doesn't, so far all the information is that the odds are incredibly low for children, because that would just be like, that's a devastating, you know, people can, if you've lived a long, full life, you know, it's different, but kids, in a sense of it, would just be so awful.
Yeah. I don't think we covered the negative visualization enough. So you've written an article about it that people can find on that. What is it? Smith Stack?
Smith.substack.com.
Okay. And walk us through the negative visualization, because I think it'll be a good way to end a conversation that had a lot of silver linings with reality in. And if we have the negative visualization, people can leave with an exercise that will be valuable for them to get their mind right, to then be open to the truth that they will see. They don't have to watch it on TV. They will now see the truth in action and be able to adjust to it properly.
So the root of it is, Epictetus talks about this, and he says, and he uses the worst example to start with. He says, you know, imagine when you kiss your child goodnight, you know, you're saying goodnight to your kid, you read him a story, you put him to bed, you kiss him on the forehead and think to yourself, you will be dead in the morning. You know, you actually think about that. Imagine what that would be like. And what it does is it forces you to, it does two things. One, it makes you deeply grateful for the moment that you have, like in a way that you can't be if you don't appreciate the possibilities of it. If you've seen your friends, you know, today or tomorrow, you might not actually see in person those friends for another month or 3 months or 6 months from now. So maybe you'll appreciate a little more, right? So if you just think about the consequences. So you imagine the detail of the negative consequences, and it makes you appreciative of the moment. That's number one. The other thing it does is that we have a vague sense of fear or dread all the time. And it's there, and you know, we don't want to look into that hole. We don't even want to imagine what's there because it seems so awful. And the Stoic view on it is that it's not as bad as your fear is about it. If you can stand up and face it, if you can actually look at it, if you can not just a glance, but like look at the details of it, look at the contours of the thing that actually scares the hell out of you, then most of the pain of it will disappear. So you imagine, like, I'm going to lose my job. What's going to happen? Like if I lose my job, then my whole life falls apart. Well, no, actually your whole life doesn't fall apart. What happens is you lost your job. And that means that you're going to have to live on the savings that you have in the bank for now. And you don't know what's going to come after that, but you know you have this savings in the bank, and you know that tomorrow you're still going to wake up and there's still going to be people who depend on you. And, you know, and then, you know, and that there's some good that you can still do. You know, so people jump to their fear being their life is over, you know, which is the consequence we feel from our fear when we feel in a vague way. But in the Stoic negative visualization way, you actually face it more deeply and you follow the logical path of your greatest fears, and you realize, okay, I can deal with that. I can at least deal with the step that's here today. I can start to work toward it. And it's less scary, and it's productive fear, at least, if it still exists at all.
You know, I've done this exercise a couple of times, and, you know, I'd always end up, well, I'd be living at my mom's house. And this was me doing the exercise while living at my mom's house at age 40. I'm like, you know, here I am, already won. And then, you know, I'm going to be teasing you a little bit here. You know, so when we went on that hike on January 27th, you know, I've lost a bunch of money this week, and fortunately I haven't made a lot of stupid decisions, but I lost a bunch. And on that hike, you told me about how much money you lost on gold futures one time. And I was, you know, it's like
almost
chump change,
basically, you know? Everything. And and I luckily managed to hold it together long enough to get out of it. But So perspective is good for sure.
Exactly. Matt, I love talking to you. And thank you for I think you've given a lot of optimism and hope and reality check to everybody listening. This is going to be really fantastic, really valuable. So thank you, my friend. And how's Royalty Exchange going?
You know, so far we've actually had a really great couple of weeks. And it could change at any moment. The financial markets are getting weird, but who knows? But I do know the team has done a great job, and the businesses, we've had a great couple of weeks, and you know, we're going to work on what we can. We're going to recognize what's in our control and what's not in our control. And we're going to do our best with what we have.
You know, honestly, I was a little scared of getting Matt on the podcast because I was already stressed out from the day. And I thought, oh my goodness, Matt's going to come on here and he's going to have even more doom and gloom because he posts a lot of real stuff on Twitter and has been for weeks about how bad it was. And as you could hear, like, Matt is very well informed from the right sources. And so fortunately, Matt also brought a silver lining. He brought a silver lining. He brought optimism to us. Now, we are going to go through hard times, but it's going to be a relatively short, hard time. We are going to survive. We are going to get stronger. We are going to become wiser. And we are going to get out of this and come through the other side and then walk, you know, kind of out of the clouds and the fog into clarity about what really matters and reorient ourselves. But we can start that today. So if you haven't done anything yet, please take Matt's advice and go and change, go and make those improvements, go and do things now, and then continue to stay plugged in here. We are going to help you get through this and survive and thrive. This is Craig Ballantyne from Early to Rise Radio, and I'm very, very grateful for you. As I've said on the podcast, I'm grateful for the small things in life, and we will talk to you soon.